Welcome to The Local Take with Kiplin Primus on Jazz 91.9 WCLK. This weekly public affairs program features dialogue and community engagement with leaders and organizations making a difference in the areas we serve.
Good morning, good people. I'm Kiplin Primus, your host for The Local Take on Jazz 91.9 WCLK. And this morning, I am proud and amazed to have Mr. Mel Pinder join me in the studio. He's an Olympian, a veteran, a native of Atlanta, Georgia, and definitely living Black history for our nation. Mel Pinder, welcome to The Local Take.
Thank you.
So I want to start about growing up in Atlanta. Can you tell us a little bit about what the city felt like, what it was like for you as a young boy growing up here in Atlanta that doesn't exist anymore?
No, it doesn't. I'm a Grady baby, and I lived in Dalton, Georgia, and we moved here in 1950 with my grandparents, a little community called Linwood Park. It's out near Brookhaven, and it's a little different than living in Dalton because I was a little disappointed in the schools I had to go to because it's in DeKalb County. It was unincorporated DeKalb County. And, you know, the school that, you know, that we had to go to, we had to get taxes to go to school. DeKalb County wouldn't give us a bus. And Miss Davis was happened to be at Turner High School. So I went out to visit them and said, look, I don't know, Mr. Davis. I don't think I want to go to school out there. I said, you got two grades in a classroom. And I'm not used to that. I said, we had a great school in Dalton. I said, I'd love to come to school out here. So I went to Turner for about a year, and then I wanted to go to NYU. So I had a buddy that was living in New York, and he had moved to Linwood Park with his grandparents. And he said, okay, why don't we go to NYU, try to go to NYU. So we moved to New York and stayed with his aunt on 125th Street between 7th and Lenox. Oh, my God. And that was a change. That was like a dream. I never thought I would ever see anything like New York City. But I've gone there one time with the school board patrol or something like that back in the day, and we stayed on 125th Street. But to live there and catch the train every morning to go to school, and you got people pushing you around, and I'm just a young country boy. I mean, it was like another world to me. And I stayed there about 6 months, and I said, no, I can't handle this. So I came back and went back to Linwood Park. They had built us a school, a little long cement block building, a little potbelly stove in the corner, with concrete floors, and a toilet was 100 meters from the school. So we had to walk all the way across the field to get to the school. I mean, the bathroom. And that was just something I just couldn't believe that we were treated that way. I was very sensitive when I was a little kid because I would see all the white schools, you know, and they had everything. We got all the hand-me-downs. We had a makeshift football team, and we got all the shoes from the school, Shamley High School, and the pants, and you had to go through like 200 pair of shoes to get a decent pair to wear. And I just said, why? We're all Americans. You know, why do we have to be treated this way? And I knew it was segregation. You know, it was still segregated. School hadn't integrated back then. So I said one day, I was telling my mom, I was standing on the corner. All we had was a little cafe where we'd go and dance on Friday nights. And we had a little jukebox, and this guy would sell hot dogs and hamburgers and a little potbelly stove to keep us warm. And that's all we had. You think you're almost in Atlanta, but you're in Brookhaven near Lenox Square, and that's where we, you know, the Black kids had to go to school, and it's kind of where we had to live. And so the police used to come up there and turn his lights off, jump out of their car and try to beat up on the biggest guys on the corner. And I ran home so fast one night, and I was crying. And my mom said, what was the matter? And I was telling, they were sitting there watching television, a little black and white television, watching some their program at night. And I says, Mom, you don't have to worry about me being out after 10 o'clock anymore. I says, one day I'm going to make you proud of me. And I just, it just came out like that. And I was very sensitive about things, and I just, what I was seeing in my neighborhood, what I was seeing in Atlanta, I didn't want that for me. I wanted a different life. You know, I wanted to go to Morris Brown College for one thing. That was my school. That was a football school. And I didn't know much about football, but I was insisting that I was going to go play football at Morris Brown College. But I joined the Army when I was 17. And I said, this is going to change my life. I knew going into the military. But, you know, as soon as we got on the bus and we was on our way to Fort Jackson, South Carolina, we stopped in Athens. And there was black and white signs, says black and white toilets and black and white water fountains. And I'm thinking if I go in the military, things are going to be different for me because I'm wearing the uniform of my country. And I had to go to the bathroom so bad, I wouldn't get off the bus. I said, no, not me. I'm not get off this bus. I'm going fighting for my country. I'm going to have to go to a different bathroom, a different water fountain. No, I'm not getting off the bus. So as soon as I got to Fort Jackson, South Carolina, I had to run to the bathroom because I was not going to get off that bus. But in the military, I used a system in the military to better myself. You know, everything they had, I was like number one in it. The physical fitness tests or keeping my area clean around my bunk. You know, I was marching and everything. You know, I cleaned my weapon. I just wanted to be better. You know what I mean?
But what was it like at 17 to be in the military? Because that was very young to enlist. And I'm sure the majority of the other folks were a lot older than you.
They were. And most of them was white. You know, we had white units. Army was integrated then, just started integrating. But it wasn't all black unit then. But they had completely integrated military. And I should think, well, you know, back then, I think black people were made to feel inferior to white people. I kind of felt inferior, you know. But when I was when I first went to the military, Fort Jackson, South Carolina, I said, I'm pretty smart. You know, I was out doing the white guys and everything they were doing. You know, you couldn't tell me nothing. I was Superman, right? And I was only 5'5", maybe 147 pounds, but they could outdo me. I would let them outdo me in nothing, running and anything. So it was tough. It was, you know, even the Army, even in the military, it was still segregated. You know, you still had problems, you know. But I made the best of it. And then I was sent to England. I was 17, going on 18. I was sent to England for a year and a half. In the construction unit, that's where we put blacks back then. They put you in construction, driving trucks, or cooks, you know. But I wanted to be an airborne. I wanted to jump out of airplanes, Special Forces, Green Beret. That was me. So I did my little through first 3 years in England, half a year, 3 years in England, another half in Texas. Then I went airborne. That was more money for me. I was married very young, very young. And that was one reason I went in the military too, because I had a baby and a young wife. And but it was $55 more a month jumping out of those airplanes. So I made the best of it, and I was sent to Okinawa. And when I went to Okinawa, that's when I realized that I could do a lot. And that's when I was playing football one day, and the coach said, look, I want you to run against the Japanese Olympic team that's training for the Olympics in Tokyo in 1964. I said, Coach, I don't know anything about track. He said, Mel, you beat everybody on the football team. Just pack up a little bag, go to supply room, and pack a little stuff up, and I'll go with you.
So did you realize at that time how fast you actually were, or was it just part of football? You didn't make the connection.
No, I didn't. I didn't know I was that fast. I didn't know I was an Olympic world-class sprinter. And I beat the best sprinter that was training for the Tokyo Olympics. And the coach said, just watch them. Watch everything they do, warming up and stretching, and just watch them. I said, okay. He said, when the gun goes off, now you know you have to go when the gun goes. I said, okay, coach. So the gun went off, and I said, oh, well, I got to go now. And at 50 meters down the track, I caught the best sprinter, was training for the Tokyo Olympics, and I won. And I had schools like UCLA, Southern Cal, Fresno State, and I had a scholarship right here at Clark. I think it was Coach Epps was a coach back in the day. He gave me a scholarship. But, you know, like I said, growing up, I didn't think I was smart enough to go to college. I still had that kind of inferior complex about, am I smart enough to do this? Am I smart enough to do that? So I reenlisted, and I got sent to the 101st Airborne Division in Fort Campbell, Kentucky, still jumping out of airplanes, making that little $55. But I was there 6 months, and they sent me to Korea. And in Korea, I played football, and a friend of mine that was working in personnel, I got a memo from Washington looking for runners to participate, to train for the 1964 games. And so I wrote a letter to the sports branch in Washington, and they gave me 2 days to train. After after I finished my tour and career, and I was sent back to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, 82nd Airborne, jumping out of airplanes again. So then I was sent to Fort Sam Houston, Texas, and that's where we trained for the Olympic Games in 1964. And that's where I met Bob Hayes, the Bullet Bob, the greatest football player ever, the fastest guy in the world. And I was like a little kid in a candy store seeing all these great college runners. And now here I am, you know, I'm at the top now, but I didn't even make the finals in the 100 meters. And that was in St. Louis, I'm sorry. It was the AAU championships in St. Louis, Missouri. That's where we went. So I got sent back to Bragg, and I says, I was about 25 years old then, 26 years old, and I was kind of old to be a sprinter. So I said, okay, watch my smoke. So I won the Inter Service Championship in the Army. I won, and then I got second in the USA Track and Field Championships, and I made the 1964 Olympic team at 27 years old. One of the oldest sprinters in the history of track and field to run as fast as I ran and to make the Olympic team in 1964. And I went back to Tokyo.
So you're back in Tokyo, but this time as an Olympian on the U.S. track and field team. And as you mentioned, you're one of the older sprinters. The majority of the folks are college kids on the Olympic teams. So what did that feel like, and what was it like competing in your first Olympics?
It was amazing. I was like number three in the world in the United States and at my age. And I was picked to be like actually second behind Bob, but I would want to beat Bob. But what happened was things happened for a reason. I was in my dorm room a day before our first race, and my buddy punched me in my stomach and bruised my ribs. And I had internal bleeding around my rib casing. So I went to the trainer. And the doctor, and he says, Mel, you can't run. He said, if you do that, you're gonna have internal bleeding. I mean, I can't. I said, Coach, I'm running. So he taped me up, and I got through the finals. Got to the finals. I got to the finals, but I must have been pretty good to get to the finals at 27, you know, taped up.
With taped up ribs.
Right. So in the finals, Bob Hayes said, he called me Shorty, because I was shorter than all the sprinters also. I was the shortest sprinter in the history of the Olympics. And he said, okay, Shorty. He said, just watch my butt. I said, what are you talking about, Bob? I said, you better watch mine. I said, I'm coming out of these blocks. He said, don't worry, you're going to be fine. He knew I was hurt, too. Mm-hmm. So when the gun went off, I got out of the blocks. I mean, I was one of the fastest starters in the world from the starting blocks. That's why I was so fast. I was so good. And I got about 50 yards down the track or 50 meters down the track, and it seemed like something inside of me is like ripped apart. And I got through the 100 meters, and I placed sixth in the 100 meters, which I should have been, you know, second or third in the top three. And I wasn't able to run the relay, and that really hurt me. And I knew at 27 I probably wouldn't be able to come back for the next Olympic Games in Mexico. So I went back to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and, of course, they still gave me opportunity to train. And during that, between that 4 years, between 1964 and 68, I set world records in the 60-yard dash and the 50-yard dash. Also at a 70-yard dash, and I was running world record times in 100 yards and 100 meters. I said, I said, watch my smoke. Here I come. So I said, I need to work on my Army career too. So I went to Officer Candidate School to be an officer. Now, here I thinking about being inferior, but I said, if I can make the Olympic team, it will be one of the best in the world. I can do this. So I took the test, passed the test, and went to Officer Candidate School down in Fort Benning, Georgia. And after that, I went to Fort Riley, Kansas. And it was the 9th Division, 6 months at Fort Riley, straight to Vietnam. It was down the Mekong Delta on the riverboats down the Delta in the jungles, fighting for like 5 months, 6 months, I think it was, and they pulled me out. Now, I'm growing on, 27 years old right now, okay, 28 years old, and 29, I was going on 29, and 2 years later, I was on the 1968 Olympic team. I made the team again at age 31. That's another history was made in my lifetime at 31 years old, making an Olympic team, running a world record time, and being like number three in the world again. So in 1968, I don't know what happened in 100 meters. I placed fifth in 100 meters. But I won a gold medal in the relay. I finally won a gold medal. God gave me an opportunity to come back and win that gold medal at 38.2 seconds, a world record in a 4x1 relay.
And now, that was the 68 Olympics. And
yes.
I've got to ask about John Carlos and Tommy Smith. Mm-hmm. And again, you're older, but you're there, so you're aware of what's going on. Did you have any idea of what they were planning? And, you know, what was the reaction from the fellow athletes on the track and field team?
Well, Carlos was my roommate. So I really didn't know what John was going to do, because he never told me. But we was having meetings, and I was like one of the oldest guys. And me and Ralph Boston was one of the two of the oldest guys on the team. So we were just like saying to the kids, we don't have to do everything together. Everybody can do their separate thing. If you want to wear black socks or black shoes, if you want to put a black ribbon on you and wear a button like Carlson did, you know, and some of the other athletes, I said, do it. I said, but everybody wasn't up to demonstrating. They didn't want to do that. Some of them didn't. And we got kind of angry with them, too, because, you know, it was for a reason. You know, like John and Carlos told me, they got railroad. It wasn't about black power salute. It was about how blacks were treated back in America and around the world. It wasn't a black power salute. It was silent gesture. Okay, we are here to let people know around the world we are human beings. We come here and win all the gold medals, and we go home, we treat it as a second-class citizen. But you know the news media, they blew it up and made John Carlos and Tommy look so bad. But it wasn't about that. But I got called in. My commander that was representing the military called me in because he had heard that I was part of the demonstration. As an officer of the United States Army, even if you were listed man in the United States Army, you cannot participate in any kind of demonstration. And I knew that. And I was watching what I was doing. I didn't want to go to jail for 20 years. I didn't want to lose my rank.
And you had just gone through officer school.
Yeah, I just gone through officer school, right. And I says, no. I says, I was not part of that demonstration, but I was part of the meetings. And I was one of the people that was speaking up to the young people there, young athletes, you know, to do whatever they wanted to do, but they don't have to be, you know, the whole team doing it. And I said to him, I says, I'm black. I said, Colonel, I'm black. So I grew up in the 60s, the 50s, the 40s. I was born in 1938, sir. Okay? And I said, how do you think I feel when I go home, even in my uniform, and I'm treated a different way? I said, how do you think I feel when I have my teammates, black teammates, want to demonstrate, you know, because of how they have been treated? I said, what am I supposed to do? I said, but I'm not going to do anything that's going to hurt my career. I said, but it hurts. It hurts deeply. And I said, even in the military, which you probably wouldn't understand, I've been treated differently also, you know, as an officer in the United States Army, even as an enlisted man. But I had to persevere. And I know I had to do things that's going to make me, you know, better. And when I go home, I can get a decent job. I said, I couldn't afford to go. I told him, I said, I couldn't afford to go to college. Back in the day, there was hardly any scholarship for blacks, and my parents didn't have any money. I said, that's why I joined the Army. I said, I know you probably don't want to hear what I'm saying to you. I said, but you got to understand who I am and how I grew up and the environment I had to grow up in the South. So he says, Mel, you know, we know that you're a good officer and, you know, blah, blah. He was telling me all this stuff because they had all our records there. They knew all about us. And I said, yes. He says, well, just watch what you do. And I went back and I stayed there about 3 days after the Olympic Games, and I went home. And when I went home, I went back to Fort Riley, Kansas. And before I went to the Olympic Games in 1968, I went to go to flight school, fly helicopters. Okay, so I passed all the tests, written tests, the physical tests, the pre-flight tests, everything. And so when I got back to Fort MacArthur, where we were training at the time, the Army team was training. They had me on orders to go right back to Vietnam. I just got out. They just pulled me out of Vietnam, okay? And they wanted me to go right back. And I says, no, I'm not going back to Vietnam. I said, I got a family. I was just rated the best physical specimen in the United States Army at my age, you know, because I made the Olympic team at 31. This big write-up in the Army Times newspaper, you know, Mel Pender, the great captain in the United States Army at his age. He's did this, and he holds world records, and he does this. And you're going to send me back to Vietnam? He says, well, you got to go. We don't think about you going to flight school. But I don't know what happened. Maybe they thought I was involved in that demonstration over there. I don't know what it was, but they sent me to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and gave me a company. I was a company commander. I was the only black company commander in the 82nd Airborne Division when I went. That was 1969. 6 months later, back to Vietnam. I was a company commander, 82nd Airborne Division. They rotated back to the States, and I worked at Ambassador Kobe, CIA, who became CIA Air Director. And I was there 9 months, and they pulled me out again. That's when I got assigned to West Point Military Academy as assistant track coach. They put me out the train at age 34, and I would have made that team. The only reason I didn't make that team, I strained a muscle in my leg 12 days before the trials. I was running really well, I set the world record, tied my world record in the 60 and the 70, and I got there, and I didn't make the finals for the 1972 games. And so I went back to West Point Military Academy and spent my last 5 years there, and it was pleasant because I love my cadets. They were my kids. They were like 19, 20 years old. And the head coach died. He was there 25 years, and I took over as interim coach. Of course, they have to go through the process, interim coach. And so I applied for the job. I was going to school at night to finish my degree. I was the only officer at West Point that didn't have a college degree. But I had been going to school everywhere I was stationed in the military. And I needed like six credits before I retired. And my retirement was in June. So I was trying to complete that my college degree because when I got out of the military, I could get a job, a decent job with a college degree. But when I applied for that job, my captain of the track team and a Major Anderson was called into the commandant's office for dinner his home for dinner one night. And he said, I want you to keep this to yourself, but West Point is not ready for a black head coach. That stays with me today. That hurts me today. That still bothers me. Because here's a guy, Bronze Star, Vietnam, combat infantry badge, and medals all over my chest, world record holder, Olympic gold medals. I mean, and I was like all-American boy, you know, who would not give me the job? But what the Secretary of the Army got involved in this and called me into the commandant's office one morning at 7:30 in the morning. He jumped on the commandant. He said, I got all Mel Pender's records right here in front of me. He said, this guy has nothing but excellent all the way through his officer career, and you're not giving him this job. I want to know why. And, of course, he didn't tell him that they wasn't ready for a black coach, but he got in a lot of trouble. And plus my athletic director got in trouble. So few months there, the commandant told the commander, give me anything I wanted. Let me stay where I was living because I need to finish my 6 credits. Mm-hmm. So I graduated in September, and I came home, and I opened a school called Athletic Attic in South DeKalb Mall. I was probably one of the first blacks in that mall in South DeKalb, which was a sporting goods store, athletic sporting goods store. And from then on, I did a lot of things. Worked for the National Football League and National Home Builders Association. And
one of the things you've done is been inducted into numerous Hall of Fames.
Yes.
So many different states have inducted you into their Hall of Fame.
Yes.
What is that like?
They say it's like telling my mom and my grandparents, I made it. you know, I get a little choked up. Just remembering that night when I told them I was going to do something great with my life, and to do all the things that I've accomplished, and to be inducted to 11 Hall of Fames,
gold medal, world records, being an officer in the United States Army, completed my college degree, get an honorary doctor's degree from Adelphi University. All these things, you know, as a black man, being made to feel incompetent, you know, being black, living in Atlanta, being treated the way I was treated in the Army, and to have been that many Hall of Fames, it's like a dream come true.
Well, this has been a wonderful dream for me to have this time to talk with you and to learn this history that so many of us don't know. And I thank you for all of those accomplishments, and I thank you for rising above all of those stereotypes and that fake information to make you feel that maybe you didn't deserve or couldn't accomplish or couldn't achieve. But you did it all, from the shortest Olympian to the oldest Olympian. You were there and you contributed to not only our country's story, but definitely to our community story. And Mel Pender, I want to thank you so much.
I want to thank you too. And I want to thank my wife. I am married to a wonderful, beautiful lady. She's a minister. And she wrote my autobiography called The Expression of Hope. You can go online and you can also, on the website, melpender.com, and look, go through the web and join the relay team. It's a beautiful website. It's about, the whole thing is about my life, and the book is an amazing book. I mean, if you read this book, and it is selling like crazy, and then people, I'm getting a lot of speaking engagements for the book, and I like talking to young kids. I like taking the book and telling them about life, what it takes to be successful in life. You know, listen to the older people. I didn't tell you about my grandfather, but if it wasn't for my grandfather, I wouldn't be the person that I'm sitting here in this chair right now. I mean, one thing he said to me is listen, he would say, read, he would say. He said, you have to be the best that you can be because who you are and the color of your skin. But I can go on and go on and tell you about my life, but the website is a beautiful website. It helps young people and old people, your older people, and to give you an insight on my life and what it took for me to be the person I am today.
And that's melpender.com.
Melpender.com.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Local Take with Kiplin Primus on Jazz 91.9 WCLK is produced by Kiplin Primus, Jami Wellman, and Rob Maynard for WCLK. If you have comments about today's program or suggestions for future programs, you can leave a voicemail at 404-880-6211 or email kiplinprimus@gmail.com. You can listen to these interviews on demand at wclk.com or via the WCLK app. Thanks for listening.